Welcome back. I hope you're feeling refreshed. About to kick off Plenary 2, which is about the actuary of the future. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Peter Corbett. I work as a life insurance actuary in KPMG. Just before we start and introduce the session, I'd like to get a show of hands as to how many people here work outside of the four traditional practice areas of life, GI, super, and investment. It's a sizable number, but not as big as I would have thought. So today's session is all about exploring opportunities that might you might come across in the future outside of the traditional areas. We've got three speakers in Mark Mayer, Nicolette Rubenstein, and Alice Trong and Jan Wang will be doing a joint presentation. So first up, we'll have Mark Mayer. Mark works at Deloitte, having transferred from the UK practice in 2014. He's worked across life and GI, including in mergers and acquisitions. He's got a very keen interest in the future of the actuarial profession. And most recently, as you may be aware, he's co-authored the Actuaries Institute paper on the impact of big data on the future of insurance. So I'll ask Mark to come up and share his views.
Thanks, Peter. So, we're here to talk about Actuary 2020, which is only in about 3 years' time, but it's more broadly the actuary of the future. And you guys who are recently qualified, nearly qualified, you guys are the actuaries of the future. And this is about giving a bit of flavor on what's out there for you guys to try, what's out there for you to do, in particular when it comes to non-traditional areas. So, things like we'll look at what's the current reach of actuaries? So what areas do we currently get involved in? What are our traditional or core areas? What is our vision for the profession or for young actuaries? And in particular, when it comes to non-traditional areas, what are our options and a little bit of advice on how we can get there, what we can do to actually achieve what we want to or to break out of the traditional actuarial fields. So here we can see our current reach, which is the green circle broadly shows our reach, right? And if you look within that, you get the dark blue circles, which are the core or traditional actuarial fields. So we all know the life insurance, general insurance, investments, superannuation. That's what Peter mentioned before. He said, put your hands up, who works outside of those fields? So I'm guessing, you know, there were a large number of you that are in those dark blue circles. Then we've got the light blue circles, which are sort of other fields, non-core actuarial, but in which we have some actuaries represented to greater or lesser degrees, hence some are sort of on the periphery and some are completely on the outside because there may only be a couple of actuaries working in an actuarial capacity in those roles. And then we've got the grey circles, which are sort of tools and techniques which we can use in our core fields, but we can also use them to expand our reach beyond core actuarial. So what is our future vision? Very broadly, there's two paths that we can take. If we look at the bottom, we can either get better at what we currently do, become more efficient and become more effective at the core actuarial work and the traditional fields we work in. And that's not what I'm going to talk about today, but it's more the top path, which is breaking into new fields. And how can we use what we already know? How can we use the training we've already got to explore different areas? So if we look at our options outside of core actuarial, look at this graph, you have skills versus fields. So from the bottom, it's existing. So that's our existing position in the dark blue circles. That's existing skills, existing fields, which is the core actuarial. If we want to break out of that mold, really, and we want to do it successfully, because you can go and you can become whatever you want, but you may not be setting yourself up for success if you don't have the right background or you don't know. So if we take either our existing skills and we try to use those in different fields, that's one way. So, for example, as we go across the fields axis to energy, sporting, farming, social welfare, we can use our existing actuarial skills and training in some of those fields, and we'll talk about some of those in the next slide. Alternatively, we can say, well, we know insurance, or we know superannuation, or within insurance, a particular area, but maybe we can actually learn new skills within our existing fields. So things like macro insurance or retail financial advice. We know a lot about insurance. We may not know as much about financial advice, but we can use our domain knowledge of insurance to actually branch out and learn new skills. So those are two ways in which you can sort of branch out of our little blue circles in the corner, going one of those two directions. So using our skills in new fields, there's a whole number of options out there where, you know, we've spoken to actuaries who are working in these areas, and I'm just going to sort of mention a couple of them and give you a bit of information, for example, on weather, and to give you an idea of why we're well placed. So we all know weather's all about uncertainty. No one knows what the weather's going to be, a lot of unpredictability. So actuaries are typically very good at handling uncertainty, and we can develop models to try and predict weather. This can help government, for example, in addressing potential food and water shortages. Or climate change is a big area that I know a couple of actuaries that are getting involved in, and it is really important for us as a society. It's not just a personal endeavor. Actuaries can be involved in weather derivatives, in valuing environmental assets, such as endangered species. Anywhere where there is uncertainty and requires some sort of framework to be put around that to help project it and give a bit of a sense of what that uncertainty may look like, that's where we can get involved. Another thing on a similar topic is farming. So also understanding the weather, but farmers may be looking to undertake certain farming projects, and we can help them model those projects to determine whether they may be profitable or not, because we understand the impacts of seasonality, which farmers may not understand, the impacts of uncertainty and adverse weather conditions, and how might that impact profit. So then the farmer can obviously make a decision on what's an acceptable risk for them to take and what's not an acceptable risk. If I look at private equity, so there is an actuary that's working in private equity, and he told us that he basically helps his firm assess the risks of other firms coming to them for funding. Now, yes, we do that a lot with insurance and risk management, but why can't we try apply those skills to assessing the risks related to any company? As long as we pick up the knowledge of that industry and we learn about that, we can use our skill set to manage risks in that way too and identify risks. What else is there? Politics I'll cover on the next slide. Macro insurance. So there's a whole world out there outside of the first world where there is a large number of underinsurance. Insurance is not very well developed. There are not many actuaries in some of these countries, in a lot of third world countries. And the biggest problem is there's different distribution channels that we're typically used to. So they don't sell insurance through the same way. It can be sold through a corner store or somewhere else. Insurance is sold in a very different way. And there's obviously a lack of data and a lack of quality data. So it's how can we try branch into those areas? How can we help countries that are severely have underdeveloped insurance industries, but obviously noting the challenge of how do we work around little or no data to try price from? And how can we try invent create new techniques to deal with this? So that's macro insurance, which is basically small insurance policies for the masses, for people who can't afford it in developing countries. So talk briefly about my experience as well. So as Peter mentioned, I was a co-author of a green paper that the Actuaries Institute recently released on the impact of big data on the future of insurance. And this is about actuaries being involved in politics. So the Actuaries Institute actually has a public policy committee, which hopefully you're all aware of. And they are thought leadership on a range of topics and concerns, and are well placed to provide advice on some of these areas, which are aimed at policyholders. And those are areas that actuaries have expertise in. So, and there are a number of actuaries that are involved in shaping public policy in health, in pensions, etc. So this particular paper, the aim of it was, we knew that there is a large volume of data that is coming out, that is becoming, that are being used by insurance companies or that will be used by insurance companies. For example, Internet of Things, every device is becoming connected, is collecting data. So all this data that is being collected and is going to be used, we want to know what were the public policy implications coming out of this, and therefore what should the government be aware of. Now, if I look at it, it required knowledge. So my background is more life insurance, a bit of banking. But if I look at that, what looks like a flower, but it wasn't meant to be, it required a bit of an intersection of insurance knowledge, analytics knowledge, big data knowledge, and public policy knowledge. And that was an area that you may say is sort of non-traditional. And my background being more on the insurance side, figured how can I be involved in this and how can I explore the area? How can I try to write a paper on this? So one, it is obviously upskilling yourself and learning about the different areas, you know, speaking to people, doing reading about analytics, about big data, doing the research. But it's also partnering with the right people. So obviously partnering with the Institute's Public Policy Committee, where they can give us some of that background, partnering with people within my own organization, because this topic was cross insurance, right? It was life insurance, general insurance, health insurance. So partnering with people who were experts on general insurance side, on the health insurance. So just because you may not necessarily be in an area at the moment doesn't mean you can't explore that area. So I think that's sort of one of my key messages here is it is about building on your skill sets, going into areas that you may have no experience, but trying to learn, trying to pick up the skills to get into that area or the domain knowledge, and partnering with the right people. So I got some insights from some actuaries working in non-traditional areas, and these were sort of their two cents worth. One was an actuary working in sports said that a lot of people maybe don't have a passion for insurance, or that's not an area that they love. They have hobbies or areas that they do love. Well, sometimes, not always, but sometimes you can apply your skills in an area that you love. And how much more rewarding would your job be then? The energy actuary said that actuaries actually need to be less risk averse and more of a risk taker. And we all know that we tend to be very risk averse. That's the nature of who we are. That's the nature of our training. But sometimes we actually need to go out of our comfort zones and take that next step and take a risk. I spoke about micro insurance and predictive analytics. So we have a bit of knowledge of the statistical processes. We have a bit of knowledge of modeling. We have a bit of knowledge of data. And we also have knowledge of insurance. And sometimes you get people who are data scientists, but they just bring one area. So actuaries can help actually bridge the gap between statisticians or pure statisticians who do some of that deep modeling and the actual business context, in particularly when it comes to insurance. And we can actually play a role in bridging that gap, helping the business understand the statisticians and vice versa. So to conclude, a few areas that I think this is some of my advice. And on the right side, we've got education. So that's more for the Institute themselves, less so for you guys as individuals, but for anyone who's going to be involved in the Institute or going to help with education, this is quite important that we need to be, if we want to branch out into non-traditional areas, if we want to be seen as being experts in other areas, we need to be trying to first and foremost incorporate that into the syllabus in some way or another. And whether that is via exam questions or scenarios, practical examples, on the communication side and negotiation side, in the CAP courses, in the part ones, we can try and mix soft skills. Again, mentioning micro insurance, try learn to price with little or no data. But as you can see, sort of communication is also pretty key if we're gonna break out of the mold and break the general consensus, which is that actuaries, we work in our little corner and we sit on our computers and calculate things. If we're going to try to break that mold, we need to be able to get out there and communicate and put ourselves in front of people. So personally, continuing with that, is don't necessarily confine yourself within insurance. Now, that doesn't mean we want all actuaries to move out of insurance. It's obviously a very large role for us to play in insurance, but there's potential for us to get involved in a number of other areas too. And as we saw, be a risk taker. Sometimes it just involves taking that next step, or, you know, like I've done the big data paper, saying, hold on, yeah, maybe I don't have an expert. I'm not an expert in this field, but but I can learn, or I can do the research, or I can partner with the right people. So taking your skills into new fields. Then on the partnering with new people, I think networking cannot be underestimated. So giving talks to other professions about what it is we're capable of, attending networking events, in particular if it relates to an industry that you're interested in, and building your network and partnering with the right people, it's getting other people to become familiar with A, what actuaries are capable of, and B, what you personally are capable of. And as I say, yeah, building knowledge of an industry and building up your contact list. And then finally, my last piece of advice is, if you do choose to go into non-traditional areas, don't think that you're no longer an actuary. You need to stay close to the actuarial profession. One, to inspire others, because if we don't know about these other people going into these areas, how are you ever going to know the art of the possible? So it's trying to inspire others and tell other people, hey, this is what I'm doing. But two, also, so that you don't completely disassociate yourself with the profession and you become aware of new techniques or new ways of thinking within the actuarial profession. So you remain an actuary, but an actuary just working in non-traditional fields. So that's my piece of advice.
Thank you, Mark. I think it broke some of the myths that working in non-traditional areas means data analytics. I'd be very interested in understanding how to become a sports actuary, as I'm sure many people here would. And it also highlighted another very interesting facet in terms of the ability to partner with relevant stakeholders, and we'll cover some of that in later plenaries this afternoon. Our next speaker is Nicolette Rubenstein. She's the Vice President of the Actuaries Institute and a non-executive director in the wealth management industry. She's held various executive positions throughout the funds management industry. And she's also authored a book called Not Guilty, A Guide for Career Mum. So I'll ask Nicolette to come up.
Thanks, Peter. Hi again. So the actuary of the future, what will they look like? I'm going to look at this question through the lens of diversity. And I'm going to try and draw on my own sort of career experiences to hopefully provide a little bit of insight. But I wouldn't be a true actuary if I didn't start with some statistics. I'm going to look at four areas of diversity, non-traditional roles, cultural diversity, gender and age. And at the very end, I'm going to touch briefly on LGBTQI as well. So firstly, we've had a little bit of discussion now, thanks to Mark, on diversity in roles. When we look at the percentage of our membership who work in non-traditional areas, you can see the bottom bar of the chart, it's about 43%. So that's the people who are working outside life insurance, general insurance, and superannuation. Interestingly, I've got a slightly different definition from Mark. So now, that's increased from 36% 10 years ago. And when we sort of scratch a bit below the surface, we see some sort of quite significant changes. While about 28% of our fellows work in life insurance, only about 19% of our students do. And while only about 2% of our fellows work in data analytics, 11% of our students do. So I've spent most of my career in what I consider non-traditional actuarial roles. So I'm going to sort of delve into this a little bit throughout. Secondly, cultural diversity. So we've got a great statistic that 38% of our members speak an Asian language. And that's made up of 25% of fellows, 41% of associates, but a massive 58% of students speak a foreign language. And I wouldn't mind a quick show of hands of who can fluently speak a language other than English. Oh, yep, that's maybe not quite 50% in the room, but close. The other thing that we know about our institute membership is that 22% of our membership is based overseas, and of those, nearly 60% are living in Asia. So in my case, I've actually lived in three different countries and worked in two different countries. If you ask me what nationality I am, I honestly cannot answer the question. I really believe I'm a global citizen. And, you know, globalization is clearly a megatrend of our century, despite Donald Trump's best efforts in the opposite direction. So those of you that have lived overseas and speak a foreign language, I think you've got a great advantage, and I really hope you make the most of that. So next, gender diversity. You can see the bar on the graph. So we've got about 33% of our membership is female, and that's made up of 25% fellows, but pleasingly 40% of associates and students. As you saw, we've got a female president at the moment, Jenny Lyon, the wonderful Jenny Lyon. A third of our counsellors are female, and we've also got some excellent female senior management in the Actuaries Institute, Elaine Grace, Sarah Tedesco, and Katrina McVagin. So gender diversity is something I'm very passionate about, and I will definitely touch on this a little bit. And finally, the bar at the top relates to age diversity. So we've got 40% of our membership is under the age of 30, but only 10% is over the age of 60. Now, my last role at Commonwealth Bank was as the general manager for retirement. So I spent quite a lot of time looking at the retirement opportunity and all of the challenges facing older workers. So I will definitely share some thoughts on that area. Admittedly, it's on the older age of age diversity, not the young, which is what you might be more interested in. But anyway. So now I'm going to turn to my sort of career history, career story. I'm going to take a bit of liberty and I'm going to start right at the very beginning. Hopefully that will add a little bit of colour and context and at the very least explain my accent. So I was actually born in the northeast of England, in Yorkshire, and my family emigrated to South Africa when I was about 13 years old, 1983. It's interesting that we've had a very strong South African contingent on the speaker lineup today. Slightly worrying. So I attended school in Durban in South Africa, high school. My parents harboured, I think, some sort of desire for me to be a lawyer. But by the age of about 16, it was already apparent that that was not going to be the right vocation for me. So my mum sent me off to the guidance counsellor at school. The guidance counsellor said to me, "What do you like? What are you good at?" I said, "Maths." She sort of seemingly opened this little pocketbook of careers and on the letter A and said, "What about actuary?" and proceeded to read out a little blurb about, you know, math, statistics, probability, and then said something about well-regarded and well-paid. And I said, "That sounds like a good plan." And really spent the next 10 years of my life working towards qualifying as an actuary on the basis of that, you know, so-called 5 minutes of so-called guidance. Anyway, I then went to university in Cape Town, where I had an absolute ball. But it wasn't all plain sailing. I managed to fail the Introduction to Actuarial Science course, which was quite a big blow at the time, given that that was my, you know, chosen direction. Anyway, after that, it went a bit better, but a few bumps along the way. So my first job was with Metropolitan Life, a life insurance company in Cape Town, but I only stayed there for about 18 months because I'd met my husband at university and we emigrated with his family to Australia in 1993. So in 1993, Australia was in the depths of a recession and they were actually making actuaries redundant, which was, you know, completely unheard of in my book. But I managed to get a job working for Towers Perrin in superannuation and spent 5 years and got a really excellent grounding in superannuation. But over time, it became apparent that valuing defined benefit funds wasn't really my thing. There's a bit of irony in that because one of the boards that I'm now on is UniSuper, which is one of the only open defined benefit funds in the country. Anyway. So by this stage, so 5 years into my time in Australia, I was really having a bit of a career crisis. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought the actuary thing is not for me. I remember thinking about, should I become a school teacher? So I really was all over the place. Anyway, I was quite drawn to roles in product development, and I particularly in retail, investment, superannuation. And I ended up taking a role for Advanced Funds Management, developing a new wrap product. So that was really cutting edge, exciting. It was a small company, but doing something that I really enjoyed. However, I was unlucky because about 6 months into that role, they bought a company called Asgard, which was the largest wrap product in the country. So my little project kind of just went up in smoke overnight. The project was completely canned. So whilst the messiness of that sort of acquisition was worked through, a job came up at BT to do product development again, but around choice of superannuation fund. And at the time, BT, and you know, still an amazing place to work, so I really jumped at that opportunity. Went to work at BT, the next company, but again wasn't lucky. I was only about 4 months into that job, and the choice of fund legislation was deferred for 3 years. So again, my whole project just evaporated overnight. But I stayed on at BT working in product development, and about a year later, I got my first real sort of lucky career break. And I was offered a role heading up the product management area at BT, which was sort of all the product managers for all the different products. So that was really being thrown at the deep end. Firstly, it was, you know, actually mostly a marketing role. It was sitting in marketing. There was all the PDSs, all the communication material, and it sort of brought home to me that writing was not really my strong suit. It was also challenging in terms, it was my first attempt at managing people, and within about 3 months of taking the role, half the team had actually left, so that was quite devastating. But that turned out to be a good thing, because I then managed to recruit the people that I really wanted in those roles, and it turned out to be a really fantastic team. One mistake I did make, though, from a diversity perspective, is I hired too many women, and we ended up with a team of about, out of 15 people, 14 were women. There was only one man. So I look back on that and think that team dynamic didn't really work quite well enough. Anyway, in the midst of this, I did an MBA through the AGSM part-time with my husband. And then I got my next lucky career break. So I got a call from a headhunter who was looking for a general manager of strategy working in at Colonial First State. Working for a guy called Chris Cuff. So he was, you know, the most revered, respected leader, and to this day is in the industry. And he'd really responsible for building Colonial First State from the very beginning. So I jumped at that opportunity. And I ended up spending about 10 years working in this strategy role at Colonial First State. And part of my responsibilities there also included advocacy, so government lobbying, working with ASFA, FPA, FSC, and I ended up sitting on the board of ASFA for 8 years, which is something I really enjoyed. So it was my time in that general manager of strategy role that did crystallise some of my thoughts on cultural diversity. So as I said, I'd lived in three different countries and I'd worked in two. When I made that move from South Africa to Australia, I, you know, really thought, it, you know, that very similar cultures. You know, they'd both been part of the Commonwealth, English speaking, like beer, play sport, warm countries. But, you know, I look back on that and it was a really flawed assessment of the cultures. The cultures are actually very different. South Africa is it really celebrates and encourages achievement. And the negative side of it is a very hierarchical society and can be a very materialistic society. But when you compare it to Australia, Australia is much more egalitarian in our outlook. But we have something called the tall poppy syndrome. If you had to explain the tall poppy syndrome to a South African, they would just not get that. It, you know, it would just be way beyond their comprehension. So when I turned to looking at Asia versus Australia, the differences there are so much greater than the South Africa-Australia cultural differences. In my general manager of strategy role, I had a bit of experience working with Asia, looking at business opportunities, particularly in China. And you know, my number one takeout was you've got to know the language and you've got to understand the local culture, and that's sort of been said, that point's been made this morning already. So given all those business opportunities in Asia, I must say I really think the actuary of the future will be able to leverage their cultural understanding and the foreign languages that they speak. And I really am enthused by that percentage of our profession that speak, particularly an Asian language. I think that will be very, very useful going forward. So during my time in Colonial First State, that's when I had my three children as well. So it's a good time to also talk about the gender diversity angle. So I am a big believer in the benefits that women bring to the workplace. I'm now very happy that there's umpteen studies showing now that statistically about what that benefit is, many of them done by McKinsey. I've also had first-hand experiences of the benefits when you have three or more women on a management team, the benefits that that does bring to that team, you know, mainly in my mind in terms of decision-making process. So the skills that women often bring to the table, based on my experience, and I hesitate to say this sometimes because it is a big generalisation. Lots of men bring the same skills to the workplace as well, but it's things like customer focus, collaboration, teamwork, compassion, and interestingly, from an actuary's perspective, risk focus as well. So over the time that I had my children, I ended up working part-time and flexibly for more than 12 years, and that was quite unusual in a general manager role. And really that's sort of, you know, when I wrote the book Not Guilty, it was really about those learnings. At the core of it is the part-time and flexible working. My main takeout out of that experience is that it is actually very hard balancing career and motherhood or fatherhood. And that flexible working is definitely a critical success factor to making it work. So I'm very heartened to see the growing number of companies that have now flexible work programs in place. If I project forward and look at the actuary of the future, I'd love to see, for those people who have children, both parents working part-time and flexibly. So, you know, in my mind, if you both did something like 4 days a week, that would be a great model. In my mind, raising children has been the most rewarding, most meaningful thing that I've done in my life. And I really believe that both parents should be able to experience and enjoy that. I think the actuarial qualification is great in this context because it really gives you, it's so highly sought after and well regarded, it gives you more negotiation power. I then got my next sort of big opportunity, which was the general manager of retirement. This was working across CBA Wealth Management. Really given a completely clean sheet of paper, big retirement opportunity, baby boomers retiring, what should our response be? And looking at the product, digital, marketing, and then distribution, working with the bank. So as I mentioned, that gave me a bit of insight into older workers, what people are wanting to do in their retirement, how they are transitioning to retirement, issues with people losing their jobs in their 50s particularly, and age discrimination. And one of the surveys that we ran, we actually asked older workers what would be the one thing that would keep them in the workforce longer. And the number one answer to that was part-time work, interestingly. That particularly resonates with me because both my parents are still working well into their 70s. They're both running their own businesses and they are working part-time. So I really would like to see the actuary of the future working more part-time, flexibly, and just reinventing how we do work, either so you can spend time with children or look after aging parents or phase into retirement or do something else that you really enjoy other than work. So back to my career story. I really enjoyed this retirement role, but I had started to think, well, what is next? What, you know, where am I going with this? I didn't have the formal career plan, but at the time I'd spoken to some very inspiring and successful company directors, and I really thought that was a career direction that matched my skill set and that I would really enjoy doing. So just over a year ago, I made quite a significant career move out of executive roles into the non-executive director space. And it's a big move because it's a real step into the unknown. You don't know if you are going to be offered these directorship positions. You need to actually build up a portfolio of them in order to make it viable. And the other thing is, it was a huge pay cut from what I was earning before. So I lined up my first directorship when I was still at CBA, and that was UniSuper, which is a big superannuation fund that sort of services the university sector. They are arguably the leading fund in the country now. They've just won every major award in the last year, so a really amazing fund, and some of you might actually be members of it. So over the last sort of year to 18 months, I've taken on three other directorships. So SuperEd is a small startup fintech robo-advice player, really exciting. OnePath is the large insurer, successful insurer owned by ANZ, well, currently owned by ANZ, I should say. And Class is a listed technology company in the SMSF space, so another sort of really exciting company. And I also went on to the Actuaries Institute Council as well. So I'm happy to say that even in this juncture, you know, all the way down the career path, my actuarial qualification has still served me well in making that transition, and it's still been a major positive in trying to get those board positions. Now, I haven't touched on the subject of the LGBTQI. Again, it's a subject that I really feel strongly about. My best friend is gay, and I very much shared his journey. I was also close to a guy who was in my team at Colonial First State who actually chose not to come out in the workplace, and that still sort of really plays on my mind. So this area of diversity, it hasn't been given as much focus from a corporate point of view as, you know, that there's very big programs being rolled out for gender diversity and cultural diversity. Where I've seen it done really well is where there is an LGBTQI person who is prepared to champion the cause, who is very senior, either the CEO or somebody reporting through to the CEO. That's where it works really well. So at the end of the day, it's about inclusion and about being comfortable to be yourself at work. So, summarising my views on actuary of the future, two things I haven't mentioned, but from my point of view, the actuary of the future will have great communication skills and also be able to embrace technology in whatever aspect of what they're doing. But specifically looking at diversity, I think firstly, many more of us will be working in non-traditional roles. I think Mark gave a great outline of what that might look like. But also you can see that my own career has sort of demonstrated, you know, strategy, product development, running big programs, and now directorships. We will successfully leverage all of this great cultural diversity in successfully doing business in and with Asia. I'm hoping that we will more successfully balance work and home life. And I'm very happy to say that Gen Y is much better and has a much better, more enlightened outlook than the older generations. But I am hoping that we will reinvent what we think of as work, and particularly part-time and flexible working. I think there will be a greater spread of ages working in the workplace, and we will value what both old people and young people bring to the table. And finally, I'm hoping that we'll be a lot more compassionate and inclusive, be we LGBTQI or everybody, and I'm hoping that everyone will be comfortable to be themselves in the workplace. So I can say that I've absolutely loved my career so far. I have thought deeply about what's important to me, and I really feel like I've been able to craft a career around that. There's no doubt in my mind that there's still lots of change that needs to be made in the workplace when it comes to diversity. But, you know, I'm very, very optimistic about the future and creating a better and more meaningful, purposeful workplace. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Nicolette, and sharing your views across a range of diversity issues. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, the actuarial qualification isn't the end, it's just the beginning, and that the opportunities are what you make of them. Our next session is on using our actuarial skills to give back, and we've got two speakers, Alice Trong and Jan Wang. Alice has over 10 years' experience in the life insurance industry and currently works at... She's worked in the corporate insurance environment, and she's also got the CIRA qualification. She's passionate about using her actuarial skills in making a difference and to drive strategic outcomes. Jan is a pricing actuary at Swiss Re, and she's held roles at MLC and Clearview, and she also holds the CIRA qualification. So I'll ask Alice and Jan to both come up.
Thanks, Peter. And thanks, Mark and Nicola. I found the presentations very insightful. I'm sure all of you agree with me. I was born in China, and both I and Alice speak Asian language, so hopefully we add a bit of diversity to the panel. Today we're going to talk about use actuarial skills to give back, and the way we're going to run the session is I'll set the scene a little bit and share with you a few stories, and Alice will share her stories working for a consulting firm in the nonprofit area. Before we start, this joke I heard a couple of weeks ago, which I want to share with you. I heard it at a stand-up comedy, and the comedian goes, "You know what I don't really understand are the trees. So for thousands of years, they try to grow their branches and roots, but they never thought of growing legs and feet. So, you know, if they have legs, and then today if we want to build a highway, and then we say, hey guys, can you move a bit? And then they can just stand up and just walk away and find another area. Then we don't need to do anything much more, right? Wouldn't that be great?" So if you imagine the trees with legs and feet, you probably think of Groot from Guardians of the Galaxy. He doesn't only walk, he also dance and, you know, fight the monsters and protect the galaxy. What I'm trying to say is, with all the technical skills and experience, a lot of time we're trying to, you know, grow our branches and roots deeper or broader, but we never give a thought, say, maybe we should explore a little bit further away from where we are and try to, you know, just like the trees, stand up and go for a walk. So the key messages we want to bring out today is around give back, skill feed, and perspective, gaining another perspective. The way we're going to do this is to share with you stories rather than talk about theories. Firstly, give back. I think working for a good cause, give back to the community, is a thing very important to a lot of us and close to our heart. And you can use your actuarial skills to do it. It doesn't need to be something completely separate from your day job or skill sets. And also it's a two-way learning process, because throughout the experience, you actually learn more and gain very valuable perspective, and which can be really helpful for your future career. So we prepared a kind of news collection for you to vote on which one you want to hear more about. So it's like, tell me more about this. As a disclaimer, something you hear next may not be 100% the same as the title suggests, which is the same as the news headlines a lot of times. So we have four different stories. The first one is three things you need to know when painting a wall. Next one, biggest givers revealed. Lifeline data sparks interest. And the last one, or not this, the third one, young entrepreneurs ready to rock and roll. And the last one is Alice's story at Guardian Actuarial, which we'll share towards the second half of the presentation. So who wants to hear a bit more about three things you need to know when painting a wall? Okay, a few. How about biggest givers reviewed? One? Oh, okay. Young entrepreneurs ready to rock and roll. Okay, seems like that's the most votes we received. I think we got votes for all of three of them, so we probably just go through. Just the slides are in that order. This is the story at my previous work, and I think a few people from MLC may remember. So a few years ago, we organized like a team volunteer day, and we went to a school for disabled children. We did a bit of gardening and painting the wall. I remember it was a really hot day, but we felt that we had a good day as a team working together, giving back to the community. But unfortunately, a bit later that day, it starts to rain, and the wall we painted wasn't completely dry, so it may end up a bit like that the next day. I guess the three things you need to know when painting a wall is, firstly, it's hard, it's a challenging job and doesn't need the specific skills, and secondly, analytical actuarial skills, probably not one of those. And thirdly, as Mark suggested earlier, it's very important to look at the weather. Maybe you should have done some weather forecast beforehand. So the next year, when we had the same opportunity to do a team volunteer day, we thought we may do something better suitable for our skills. So we organized a hackathon day. So what we did was we got about 30 actuaries and data scientists in the room with 5 or 6 nonprofit organizations. And then we asked each of them what are some problems or issues they would like to solve that involves data analytical skills. And they gave us specific questions. So we broke down into 5 groups and work on each of those. So the nonprofit there were social venture, which they help to create better education and employment outcomes for disadvantaged Australia. Good Beginning, they called Save the Children Now, so they provide support for a good beginning for every child. Lifeline, which is the example we'll show today, they provide 24/7 crisis support and suicide prevention services. Life Changing Experience Foundation provides youth support to Australia's most marginalized girls, and also a science researcher who studied koala population in the Coffs Harbour area. So for Lifeline, the problem they want to solve is to look at how successful they have been in the past telemarketing campaigns to collect donations, and in terms of cost and benefit, and also in terms of trained or by regions, by donors, and all that. So we look at the different aspects. The first graph is, it might be a little bit smaller to see, but you can see it's the by campaign over time, it's a trending up of the amount collecting, which is a good thing. But the next one, that's the average by per person or per donor, but you can see that is actually not going up as the first one. So it's kind of consistent over time. And then if we move down to the average by state, the most raised is represented by the bar, which is New South Wales. But the average across the state are actually quite similar, with a bit of spike in ACT. And then the last one is by gender. It seems like female are a bit more generous than guys. or the average is actually the different. So that's just an example of how analytical skills can be used outside your traditional working area and can be helpful for a nonprofit organization to look at their data. Let's go into the last, second last, which is the most vote received. This is an initiative organized through the partnership of Education Pathways and Swiss Re Foundation. And in December last year, seven mentors from Swiss Re went to Manila with 42 Filipino students, and they participated in a one-week program, which tried to help those 42 students to gain a bit of understanding of the business world and also build up their critical skills in terms to be a young entrepreneur. Throughout the week, they learned a lot of business knowledge in terms of, for example, concepts of risk, what's insurance for, how to create a business plan if they want to start their own business, bookkeeping, financial statements. They also did a bit of skill development in terms of communication skills, teamwork, time management, and all that. But towards the end of the week, each of the students pitched a business idea to the panel, and then the winner actually got the funding, the opportunity to take the idea forward. So I just put a few examples of the pitching they did. For example, education center, sustainable food. So one of the participants from Swiss Re actually made a comment. Throughout the experience, he found a lot of the business pitching ideas are quite community-centered and also focus on sustainability, which to him is a valuable insight and perspective gained throughout the experience. That's why earlier I said it's a two-way learning experience. So today I've invited one of my colleagues here, Larissa. She participated in this program last year. So if you have any questions for her or want to hear a bit more of the story, please feel free to speak to her. She's not an actuary, by the way, but she's happy to mingle with the 150 actuaries, I guess. I may stop here and then hand over to Alice, and then she will talk about her experience at Guardian Actuarial.
Thanks so much, Jan. I'm Alice, and I'm really excited to be here despite having a fractured ankle. So can I have a quick show of hands who's enjoying the conference so far and are feeling happy? Oh, come on. We should see 100% here. We're getting recorded. It's all right. It's okay. So today I'm going to share a little bit about my story, how I was able to use my actuarial skills to give back, touch a little bit on the motivation, my motivation. Oh, my slide didn't come out properly, but it looked prettier. Sorry about that. It looks a bit bland, but hopefully my presentation won't be bland. And touch a little bit about what I've gained through the motion and my emotional journey. So the first 12 years of my career I've spent in life insurance. I've worked at BT, MLC, in pricing, valuation, capital, and all those years of experience really put me in my comfort zone. I was safe, I knew what I was doing, really comfy, but I always knew that I wanted to do something different. I wanted to be able to use my actuarial skills and give back. And I was really, really lucky to have been given that opportunity to do that and work with Julia Lessing at Guardian Actuarial. Guardian Actuarial is a consultancy focused using actuarial skills in the human services sector. Now, I was really excited, but at the same time, it took me back to, you know, when I first graduated from uni, that kind of anxious feeling from the uncertainty. Then I started questioning myself, oh, can I add value? I know nothing of the industry. What if I don't meet expectations? What if I disappoint Julia? What about the Guardian Actuarial brand? What about the actuary brand? But even with all that in the back of my mind, I decided to just go for it. You know, I broke through my comfort zone and headed straight through that door of opportunity. And you know what? I was just being a worrywart. There was actually nothing I needed to be scared about because all those years of being an actuary had really equipped me with the skills that I could draw upon. So I worked in, you know, I was really lucky to have worked in, you know, for me, really new and exciting areas. I worked in projects on child protection, on social housing, and you really needed to think outside the box, and hence why they're in hexagons. But yeah, using actuarial skills and applying them in a very different context. But there were its challenges. So I'm just going to, you know, get you guys to help me out again. Can show me, you know, hence show me if you think that actuaries can put a dollar value quite robustly and accurately on reserves, on a capital amount, on pricing, a premium. I should see 100% again, but that's okay. So earlier in the presentation, I asked you how you felt and if you were feeling happy. Now, can any of you quite accurately put a dollar value on the collective happiness of the feeling of happiness that the delegates in this room are feeling? Wonderful. Nobody. That's what I expected. And that is the biggest challenge in this space, because often in the social space, it's things like feeling safe, feeling empowered. How do you put a dollar value on that? And I think there's a long way to go in that area, but, you know, I think actuaries can provide some thought leadership. So the whole experience for me has been priceless. It's one of the, you know, the career highlights that I've had. And I thought I was giving back, but you know what? I think I actually gained much, much more in return. So whilst I might not be donning a kind of a red cape anytime soon, I am now confident to push out of my comfort zone and push those boundaries. Speaking here today, I've not actually ever spoken to such a big audience, so please excuse me if I kind of stuff up a little bit. And, you know, thinking outside the box, really trying to work that creativity, using actuarial skills in areas where you haven't been before. Learning, you know, growing and development is really a key of my kind of leadership philosophy. And without learning, you're not going to grow. So being able to move out into kind of my comfort zone and really, I really had an exponential learning curve. And I will ever be so grateful for Julia, who was the director at Guardian Actual, who really taught me so much. And she is a great leader, mentor, and friend. Also, you know, really gained a deeper appreciation and understanding of the social issues that we face. And I know it's going to sound corny or cliche, but if we all did a little bit, it will help make the world a better place. So, you know, I really hope you guys have enjoyed the stories that Jen and I have shared with you today, and just a glimpse of into like what actuaries can do. Actuaries can give back and, you know, contribute to a good cause. We can apply our skills, experience, and problem solve in new areas, and really to kind of broaden our perspective. Not only are we giving back, but we're also getting so much more in turn in terms of valuable insight and experience. So thank you.
Thank you, Alison Chang, a very uplifting presentation, and thanks for sharing your insights. So I'll now ask all four members or four speakers to come up and we'll have a bit of a Q&A. So, happy to take your questions. Maybe I'll get the ball rolling. A question from Mark. How do you become a sports actuary, and what type of work would you think they would do?
So, you go and you become a professional footballer, and you're a qualified actuary who plays sport. So I think there's an actuary in the US, what's his name, John Dewan. Yeah, and he was very passionate about baseball. So he started a statistics company collecting all stats on baseball and sports. And that was his passion. That's what he built his company around. And because sport ultimately is a lot about statistics, and it's about giving the stats on screen, and it's about that's how people now make decisions whether to buy or not. So he then sold this company to Fox Sports for $45 million, the sports stats company. There are, in cricket, for example, now these weren't actuaries, they were statisticians, but if any of you know or watch cricket, you've heard of the Duckworth-Lewis system. So that was two statisticians who came up with a system of what happens if a cricket game is shortened by weather and we have to work out what's the new par score or what's the new winning score. So that was a bunch of statisticians, but that gives you an idea of the types of things that actuaries can do in a similar field. What else was there? So one thing which I don't know if actuaries are involved in, but was something that I really thought would be cool, is especially in, you see this in the English Premier League soccer, but I'm sure the same thing happens here with AFL, but just much smaller numbers. But you see players getting sold for £100 million, €100 million, like huge sums. And you always wonder, you know, how do they come up with these numbers? It's probably more market value, and there's probably no real science behind it. It's just, oh, he was better than that player who sold for $90 million, so we'll offer 100. But I think that maybe, perhaps, that's an area where we can apply a bit more science to working out the actual value of a player and how much they should be bought or sold for.
Hello, Jan and Alice. I've just got a general comment. I was really interested. You both have the CIRA background, and then Alice talked about the difficulties in quantifying what's unquantifiable. And I was thinking, you know, from a CIRA perspective, how we apply an insurance or an organisation, if you think of it, in a risk role, we do actually have to do that quite a bit. And things like strategic risk or brand risk, if we could apply those skills to it, that's what companies actually need from actuaries. So that's my comment. Now I've got a question for Alice, and I would like you to answer this in an Asian language, please. So in going and working out, working at Guardian, can you comment on, you know, the different style? How did you have to adapt to that environment? Because your background was largely corporate, you know, large organisations and things like that. Now you're working for Guardian Consulting, but mostly for charities and so on. So different styles, how you have to adapt in an Asian language. I look like I can speak an Asian language, but I can't. There's diversity for you.
I'm not actually very fluent, that's why I didn't put my hand up. But I can if you want, and then no one would understand what I'm talking about. No, it was actually very different kind of environment and culture as well. I think when you work in some of my clients, they're actually really, really passionate about the cause. And, you know, sorry to say, there wasn't a lot of politics. And that was a refreshing kind of, you know, change to experience. I think, you know, it was difficult because you needed to actually get into the jargon of things. Like, you know, people here will probably think DAC as deferred acquisition costs. And when I heard DAC, I was like, what? It was actually data analytical center. So it was actually upskilling and really getting to know and understand, like Mark was referring to, being able to understand the industry and really do that research. So yeah. That was thank you in a Chinese dialect.
A question up the front.
Hi there, George from PDubs. So question for Alice. So we heard a lot in the previous session around, well, this is sort of the right time to move like overseas. In terms of then moving into, say, the sort of not-for-profit sector, do you have any advice or thoughts around, well, what's the right time in your career to do that? Because, you know, just thinking, coming out of uni, you're fresh, you know, fresh-faced and like, oh, I want to change the world. You hit work and you're like, oh, wait, no, I'm not changing the world yet because, well, obviously I don't have any skills. So what's your thought around, yeah, that sort of timing?
I think just do it. Like, Liz was saying, just do it. I think it's really driven off your passion, and if you have a passion for something, then you definitely will move towards actually preparing yourself and actually doing better, and you'll feel so much more rewarded for what you're doing. So anytime, just do it.
Hi, my name is Nihirika. I'm from EY. I had a question for Nicolette. So you mentioned in your speech about you ended up hiring too many females in your team and that wasn't quite a good balance. And at the same time, in your statistics at the front, you showed that there's not very many females who work in actuarial. And I know there's a big push in a lot of companies to hire more females, but at the same time, you don't want to hire them just because they're female. Do you find that it's hard to strike that balance? And what do you think can be done to better improve the gender diversity, especially in actuarial?
I've been quite heartened by what I've seen companies do on this, the sort of recruitment side of gender diversity. So, you know, the whole thing about make sure that there's women on the shortlist, make sure that there's both male and female interviewing the people. And this sort of experience that I've seen in recent years, you know, often that rule of if there's a man and woman exactly the same, then you would give it to the woman, but always making sure that you do it on merit. So, you know, I think the worst thing from any woman's point of view is getting a job because you're female. So, you know, when you sort of apply those rules of it must be based on merit, but if there's a sort of same-same, you would give it to the woman for the benefit of the team dynamic. The experience I've had is that actually does work quite well, and I have seen women coming through. And it does look like 40% of our students and associates are female. So I think we are going in the right direction. You know, quite a bit controversially, I don't think we will ever get to 50% on boards and in senior management. So, you know, I think that the number, if there's one, it's somewhere between 40 and 50, because from an actuary, you kind of want to put a number on it. But I think that a lot of women, you know, my starting point is that, you know, men are different from women. We are physically different. We've got different hormones. Women bear the children, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And that women on average are more nurturing than men, and therefore women on average will take longer out of the workforce to care for children. And obviously what I've said, I would love to see a much greater sharing of the children, raising children between the two parents. But I think on average women will do a longer time out. And therefore, when you're looking to recruit on board positions and things like in senior management, you will, by definition, your population will be skewed towards male. But, you know, people don't all share that view, and it's interesting. I'm happy to have a conversation during lunch on that subject.
Hi. Hi, Jack with MLC. We've talking a lot about branching our career outside of the core business, like insurance, superannuation, investment, to other areas. I'm just wondering, in your opinion, what are the advantages that actuaries have over the, say, predominant players in the market? Say, in predictive analytics, what are the advantages for actuaries over data scientists or statistician over there?
Yeah, so I think if you sort of go back to that first graph, well, the graph where I had skills on the one axis and fields on the other axis, as I said, it's not just about actuaries going, oh, we can do anything, and I want to become a professional cricket player, so I'm just going to go and do that. You've got to start with some base of, as I say, either taking our skills and applying those to new fields, or saying that we actually know insurance, which is our field, we know insurance well, and learning new skills. Now, what might be our advantage over, say, a data scientist? As I said, is the data, I think in order to do effective analytics, you need a combination of the statistical capability, you need the sort of computational or coding capability, and then you also need the industry and domain knowledge. And it's about sort of a blend of all of those three together that gives you real effective analytics. So data scientists may come at it from they know the statistics, or they may even know also the coding side of things, but they may not have that domain knowledge that's where we can contribute, and we can help being the bridge between all those areas because we know a bit about them all. And yes, maybe we're not as effective data scientists as people who have done their PhDs in statistics or whatever, but we've got the right combination of all of those cornerstones.
Just add a bit of thoughts on that topic. I think what we usually call it problem solving, but I actually prefer to call it connecting the dots, because problem solving is implying that there's a problem and actuaries go and solve it. It's quite a problem driven. Where connecting the dots is to say you have the different things and you put them together to come up with the solution, which I think is what we good at. We may not have the perfect data, which we all know we don't all the time, but we connect things together and come up with a solution. I think that's the advantage we have.
Hi, I'm Angela from Finity Consulting. I have a question for Mark. You mentioned a few times about microinsurance. How does it work? Does actuaries have to live in the country of where the microinsurance product is sold? And if not, how can actuaries in Australia support that product being sold overseas?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure where the actuaries necessarily need to be based. I would imagine there's probably no reason why actuaries here can't give advice or work on, you know, microinsurance arrangements overseas, with the caveat being that salaries in Australia are a hell of a lot higher. So I can't imagine people in third world countries paying actuarial salaries. But yeah, that would probably be the biggest barrier.
So one up the front.
The microinsurance example, we've actually got members who do actually work in that space, so you know the institute can connect you with them if you want to talk to them. On hackathons, and I think some of the people in the audience were talking about trying to move into this area and so on. Large organisations tend to have these volunteer days, and Jan, you started talking about that 2-day hackathon that we had at MLC. I mean, so many organisations do that. Do you think that's a way to both use and work as an actuary, but then also contribute to society without having to completely move out, move countries?
Yeah, definitely, I agree with you. And the earlier question on when is the good time to quit your job and say, I'm going to do this, I guess you don't have to do that. Like if you are of a big organization, this is the opportunity. You can take the idea back and share with your company. This might be something you can do for a day or for a week, which you can have a good taste of what kind of things you can do and can help without just, you know, quit your job and then say, this is it.
I've got a question for the panel. All of you started off your careers in a traditional area, but you've moved outside of that over time. Can you maybe explain about how you overcame the fear of stepping out of the comfort zone? And you know what it was like living in a world that was a bit more uncertain to what you were used to.
Fear of stepping out of your comfort zone. The first one, when I did make that conscious move out of an actuarial role, I feel like I was being driven. It was just so quite clear to me that I was in the wrong place doing the wrong thing. And I probably sat in that role for 2 years too long doing the wrong thing because I was so scared about moving out of it. And what helped me, I just started reading job ads and sort of started thinking about what would be more appealing. And then this more recent move into the director's space, I just went around and I talked to a lot of chairmen, chairpersons, people on boards, and I spent a lot of time headhunters just going around and chatting and getting advice. And I guess, you know, I think that is a great, you know, piece of advice. Just, you know, use your network, but go around and just talk to people. And in a lot of cases, it was people who knew people. I didn't know them directly. Somebody just put me in touch with them via email, and I said, can I have a coffee for half an hour? And because these directorships, all of mine apart from one have come through who I've known, not through headhunters. So it is about getting out there and talking to people.
I don't see myself as someone that necessarily now works out of traditional actuarial. I still work within traditional actuarial. I just have taken on some projects and some interests outside, but I still, you know,
inside the box.
I'm probably similar to Mark, but I think fear is something, not necessarily when you change your career and all that, you face a lot of times, but to me, I felt, you know, fear when I change roles or change companies, and I might be a bit nerdy, so what I did was I sat down in front of my laptop and opened the spreadsheet, and then put two columns, pros and cons, and then I list all the factors I'm uncertain about for this change. So if saying this role, I'm going to be, this is good, but then all these bad things, and if moving over, there are all the good things and bad things, and kind of try to justify my choice. I guess it's still a bit of actuarial, but that's the way I deal with it. Not suggesting you do the same.
I'll actually give you this triggered a memory. Someone told me about this something a while back, the concept of different types of doors. And they say that there's one-way doors and there's revolving doors. And sometimes you make a decision where you go through a door and you know that once you've made that decision, there's nothing you can do to change that. So, for example, having kids. Once you have a kid, you've had a kid. you cannot go back on that decision, right? that's something you can't change. But going into a different role or trying something different, especially once you've built up the actuarial skills, and in particular once you've qualified, it's a bit of a revolving door. You can walk out and you can try something, and if you realize it's not for you, you can still come back in through the door and continue working. As long as you've got the right grounding and qualification in actuarial, you can still come back. So it's not a one-way thing where you try it and it's all doom and gloom.
I've got another question for the panel. So what's your advice for young actuaries who has ambitions in a strategic management role in the future?
So I do an MBA. my view, the strategy roles are hard to get. So the strategy departments are often really small, and if you can get a job at McKinsey or Bain or something like that, that's a really good place to start. The other sort of natural moving sort of, if you want to try and position yourself to get a strategy role, is to go into a product area and get some experience there. But yeah, when I took my strategy role, I think mine was one of the first in the country in superannuation and funds management. The banks all had strategy areas, but there weren't any that I knew of in sort of the wealth industry. So it was easier to get in, whereas now I think, they're a bit more established, but there's still very few roles in them.
Hi, my name is Mel from Finity. I've got a question about gender diversity to Nicolette, but I'm pretty open to hearing general comments from the rest of the panel. So there are a couple of professions that are pretty notorious for being, old boys clubs, such as, the medical profession, the legal profession. I was just wondering if you've experienced or observed any specific issues for women in the actuarial industry and how you've managed to address them over your career. And whether you think there are any key strengths that as a woman, we could sort of put forward and really market to assert our position in this industry.
Oh, good one. I have to say, to start off with, that I feel like I have had equal opportunity in my career. So, my view at the moment is there's such a positive tide supporting women and trying to get a more equal balance that if you just put your hand up and be a bit brave, you will get the opportunities that they're there for the taking, in my mind. There was a great survey recently as part of International Women's Day that actually asked women what was the one thing that was preventing them from doing what they wanted to do. I think it was because the theme was about being bold. So, you know, you would expect to come up as the results of that survey are, you know, men are getting all the opportunities, or my partner's not supporting me, or those sort of things. But the number one thing that came up was actually confidence. So women's confidence was, so it was an internal issue to women themselves that's holding them back. And that's something that I've given a lot of thought to, and and certainly confidence is something that sort of racked me a lot over the years, and there's now a great book specifically on called the Confidence Code, which goes into sort of women's lack of confidence and why we are seemingly less confident. Sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Sorry, I gave the microphone away. I was just wondering what you thought maybe there are. You know, if there are key strengths that are specific to women that we should, you know, market to assert our position.
Yeah. So I do think that it's, you know, I sort of mentioned very briefly in my presentation, there's now a lot of stats that really evidence why women are good for the workplace. So, you know, they basically show greater profitability, less risk of imploding a company, greater growth, you know, all of these sort of things. If that companies that have got reasonable gender balances either on boards and in senior management. So in my mind, step one is women should just be more aware of those statistics, because it absolutely makes you more confident about being yourself in the workplace. And when I first started, my first job, as I said, was in a South African life insurance company in the actuarial area. So it was about, you know, as gender imbalanced as you can get as a work environment. And I feel like at the time I took on a lot more sort of, I don't know, it's hard to say, but kind of male ways of operating, or, you know, just because I thought that that was the way to get ahead. Whereas now I think I'm much more confident in being myself in the workplace, which might be things like compassion, empathy, customer focus, collaboration and teamwork. Those are sort of all the skills that women, I think, should be a bit more confident in bringing to the table, and not, you know, trying to act like men, which is what, you know, you can be inclined to do if you're not feeling that confident.
Thanks, that was really insightful.
Hi, I'm Jess. I'm still studying at Macquarie University, and it's just a question for Nicolette. So you said that you're quite passionate about the inclusion of the acceptance of the LGBTQI community, and I just wanted to ask, because you did mention that, you know, you can be really effective if you're kind of close or at that higher executive level, but for people who are kind of just, you know, ordinary, not that quite there yet, like, what are some things that we can do to kind of implement that inclusion, and what are some steps that you have taken personally to kind of pitch that forward?
Yeah, good question. I think firstly, anyone who is a manager, just making it completely safe for people within your team. So just start at that really micro level, you know, safe for them to come out in the workplace. You know, what kills me the most is that people can come to work and have to put on a, you know, veil of pretending to be somebody that they're not. So, you know, and I guess at the end of the day, that's about communication, and it's about really understanding your team members. You know, if someone hasn't mentioned that they've got a boyfriend or a girlfriend, then, you know, without prying to, but, you know, try to show that you've got an interest and get to know them. Really good friend of mine that has been a friend of mine for about 20 years now. So he didn't come out until he was about 30. This is not my best friend. It was an actuarial guy that I worked with. And I think he was trying to tell me for years. He really was. But the way he, and I must say my own gaydar is almost non-existent. I think I'm hopeless. But the way he told me in the end, he showed me this sort of, we were talking about going to the Mardi Gras party, and he showed me this little pair of trunks, and he said, "That's what I'm wearing." And I still didn't realize he was gay. So, you know, sometimes I just think we're just a bit, you know, we're not open, and it's all about communication and understand the people who work for you and understand their personal lives.
Got time for another couple of questions before lunch?
Hi, this is Shubham from RGA. Thank you for the presentations. This question is for Alice. Can you please share with us a recent experience where you worked on a social project and you use skills which are unique to actuaries rather than other professions as well?
Sure, just with the child protection that I mentioned. So a client engaged us to look at a model, which is to actually project the number of vulnerable children in the system so that they could obviously manage programs to help them. And if you think about a child protection system, you've got them going into out of home care, getting to 18, going out of the system. It actually kind of similarly looks like a income protection model. You're in different states. Yeah, you're in different states. What's the probability of moving into that state? What's the duration, the distribution of the distribution staying in that state? So you could draw kind of, you know, parallels to and where we can actually help and review that model.
Any more questions?
Hi, my name is Dan from AMP. I have a more simple question. So when you're dealing with external stakeholders outside of the insurance industry, when people ask you, what do you actually do? What do you usually say? A question for all of you. Thanks.
Absolutely. And that's why we have a presentation at the Think Differently Summit that will actually, we surveyed some non-actuary perspectives on what actuaries are, and there's interesting findings there. So, you know, check it out. If you don't get to go, then check it out. Check out the presentation and the results.
Okay, and final question.
Hi, Shane from PwC here. So as someone who's really, early on into their career, how do you kind of push towards getting involved in more non-traditional areas when a lot of employers are kind of, you know, still really big on the traditional stuff?
So did you say you at PwC? So I think that's a great base. Being in a consultancy typically gives you that opportunity to explore other opportunities because you don't have necessarily just one role or one position. It'll be presumably very project based. So, you know, I would expect that across your organization or across the whole range of consulting or different areas that you guys tend to work with, there'll be projects where actuarial skills can be used outside of just the pure actuarial projects that you guys get. So definitely put your hand up, speak to the partners, speak to your resourcing managers and say, you know, I would like to get involved in some of these projects. And you may be surprised that actually you get put on a project that you didn't think that actuaries were actually working on.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks very much, everyone, for your questions. If more thoughts come to you later than today, I'm sure our presenters would be happy to answer questions whilst they're still around. But for now, I'd like to thank Nicolette, Mark, Alice and Jan for providing their time today.